Hey friends, it's Melvin. I hope that you're doing well. So we're actually on break from the Selling the Couch podcast, but I hope that you enjoyed this podcast conversation from our archives. In the meantime, if you are thinking about creating an online course, I know that many of us may be thinking about that right now in the midst of the pandemic and in a post-pandemic world, whether it's just to diversify our income beyond therapy work or just to feel like we have a bigger message to share and we want to be able to share that in a different way beyond just our geographic area. If all of that sounds awesome and you've been thinking about creating an online course, I just wanted to invite you to download the free A to Z online course guide. I launched my first online course back in 2015 to a $297 first sale. And through a lot of just hard work and a lot of trust in colleagues to purchase the course, we've now had over 275 of our colleagues purchase the Healthcasters podcasting course. And I've learned a ton about what it takes to launch, grow, and scale a podcasting course and a course in general. And that guide just has a lot of helpful information to help you get started. We're also launching something called Online Course School. This is a live cohort experience. So meaning that this isn't like a digital course on courses, although eventually it will have that. But this is more of a live experience where we therapists can gather over the course of 6 to 8 weeks. And what I will do is I will teach you everything that I know about how to launch and grow a successful online course. We'll start with your idea and how to validate your online course. We'll then work through what your lessons and modules and all of those different things will look like. We'll actually take time and actually do exercises to get those down. We'll come up with your course title and your subtitle in a way that your students are excited to want to purchase that course. And then we'll talk about actually how to record and market your course as well. And you'll be joined with others in community, and you'll have an accountability buddy and a bunch of really awesome stuff. And if any of that sounds awesome, I encourage you to download again the online course guide over at sellingthecouch.com/online course guide. So we'll get right to today's session. Have a great rest of your day. Hello, hello. Welcome to session 181 of Selling the Couch. Hope you're having an awesome start to your day. So today's podcast topic is one that I've been wanting to have an episode on, which is how in the world can we as clinicians create a sound social media policy? I feel like in this day and age of 8 million social media platforms, well, maybe not that many, but a good number of social media platforms. How do you navigate the world of social media, in specifically the intersection of social media with our personal lives and then with our professional lives? My guest today is Dr. Keely Combs. And Keely and I had reached out. I mentioned this right at the beginning of the interview, but Keely was one of those guests where I thought, man, that would be so awesome to have Keely on the podcast. And it worked out. But Keely's name has come up numerous times. They are an expert when it comes to social media policy and thinking through a lot of stuff. So we're going to cover a range of things in today's podcast conversation. So first, we're going to start about and just talk about what exactly is a social media policy. And then we're going to go really deep into some of the tips in terms of how we can create a sound social media policy. And then we'll wrap up with some of the biggest issues that Keely has seen in their practice, in their consulting practice, when it comes to struggles that clinicians have. When you get to that part of the podcast conversation, I think you're going to be like, oh my gosh, either this has happened to me or I know of someone that this has happened to. But before we get to today's podcast conversation, I just wanted to take a moment to thank the team over at RevKey for being wonderful supporters of the STC podcast and specifically this episode and all of this month's episodes. If you guys are looking for help with Google AdWords and just managing a Google AdWord campaign, I encourage you to check out RevKey. RevKey is owned by a partner of someone I went to grad school with. Shout out to Laura. And one of the neat things is that because John, the owner, has worked, has helped Laura with her private practice and implementing Google AdWords. He knows a lot about the unique nuances of our field and the challenges. And it's a wonderful service, especially if you are looking for targeted folks for your website, and then also very specific clients, ideal fit clients. You can learn more about Refke and the work they're doing over at sellingthecouch.com/Refke. And if you go through that link, there's actually a nice little discount code for STC listeners. So we'll get right to today's podcast conversation. Here's my conversation with Dr. Keely Holmes from drkholmes.com. Hi, Keely. Welcome to Selling the Couch.
Hi, Melvin. I'm happy to finally be here.
I am so glad you're here as well. I was telling you right before we started recording, I remember when I first started Selling the Couch. I mean, this was actually even before I recorded a single episode. You were one of the first folks that I reached out to, and I had heard your name. Your name had come up in multiple places, and multiple people had told me, you should reach out to Keely if you want to, you know, talk about social media stuff. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And I remember I was literally sweating bullets when I reached out to you. And I'm so grateful, for one, that you're on the podcast. And I don't know, through the magic of internet and email, that we've been able to connect.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much. And I hope you're feeling calmer now.
Yes, I guess after 170 of these episodes, a little bit better now. So I wanted to talk about this topic because, I don't know, just as the world of social media expands and new sorts of opportunities to market and things like that come, I think there is a lot of wisdom in thinking about the other side of this, the legal side, and just making sure that as we enter into these various channels, as we interact on these channels, that we are doing our due diligence. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, me too. I'm interested in what you have to ask.
Yeah. We'll just jump right in. So I wanted to start kind of basic, which is, what in the world is a social media policy?
Well, a social media policy is a document that we provide for our clients that explains how we use technology in our practices and how our clients can expect us to respond to potential interactions online. And it also can help clients to think about, it can help frame the clinical relationship. So it's really a document that answers anticipated questions. And I think of it as a really important part of informed consent. And informed consent, at least for therapy, we also have to do that for assessment and research and other professional activities. But most of us are practicing in disciplines that say that as early as is feasible in therapy, we let our clients and patients know about the anticipated course of therapy, fees, involvement of third parties, limits of confidentiality, and we give folks a chance to ask questions and get answers. Mm-hmm. So I see this as part of really doing a thorough job of including not only what happens in the room, but what might happen outside of the room on the internet.
Yes, I think, like, at a practical level, this could be like what happens in a situation. I'm sure this has happened to lots of folks, where a potential client reaches out on a Facebook business page or via private message or something like that.
Exactly. Like, when I wrote the policy, I was thinking about things like contact requests, maybe even when you see a friend of yours retweet someone who you recognize as someone in your practice, you know, what should you do? Should you click on that and read further? Or should you think about what the implications might mean? And even questions such as, should I Google a client, or is it appropriate to gather information in ways that the internet allows us to about someone who's in my practice and under my care?
Got it. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I actually, you started to answer this, and I'm curious, what made you, like, personally, what made you actually create a social media policy?
Yeah, I was starting my private practice in 2008. And there were a couple of things. One was that I was asking myself these questions, partly because I had a very rich search and social internet life prior to starting my practice. And then I was creating this separate professional identity. You know, some people feel like it's a very integrated identity. And I think for me, I was working really hard to create a separate professional identity. And I started anticipating all of these potential dilemmas. And then right around that same time, I actually watched a video presentation that Dr. Jeffrey Barnett, and he's a pretty well-known ethicist, that he was doing on ethics and the internet. And he was talking about how it would be really great to include some sort of policy that talks about what you might do. So I started looking for one. I thought, oh, that's so great. I need to get my hands on one of those social media policies so I can think about what I would put in my own. But I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find anything at all. So it ended up being the impetus of my thinking through where do I think the problem areas might be? You know, what seems risky or challenging? What do I anticipate could happen? And then how do I want to manage that? And it also gave me an opportunity to look at my own ethics code, which I always encourage people to do, review your own ethics code, because most of the challenges that we're encountering online are the same ones that we encounter offline and in our, you know, practice lives in the room. But it gave me an opportunity to kind of wed the two and think about, well, what would my ethics code want me to do about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's just even in my own personal life, like I was thinking, you know, for me, like I resonate a lot with what you're saying, because I'm constantly trying to navigate this world of, you know, having this sort of public profile, right? Versus with selling the couch, and then I have a small private practice. And so how do I sort of manage that? Then the intersection of when clinicians reach out to me, when, you know, if potential clients reach out to me, all of those things. And I feel like it's only going to get more complicated, you know, as
right.
The social media world just, I feel like, expands, you know, so quickly.
Well, there's a way also that I think, and maybe this was less comfortable for people a decade or two ago, kind of this sense that we are all, at least if we're on social media, some sort of media figure. And I think some more traditionally trained clinicians who were not so active on the internet might feel like they really had, you know, maybe their patients were curious about them, but there was a time where we were a little bit more shielded. But now it's becoming almost impossible unless you really are determined to not have any online presence. So it's almost like it's just a natural thing now that information about us is out there. And we work with people who may be just as curious about us as we are about them.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to look at it. So for those of you guys that are listening, one of the things that we are going to do with this conversation is break down just some of the common mistakes that clinicians make when it comes to social media policy, and then also just some of the tips that we can incorporate in terms of creating a sound social media policy. So Keely, let's jump right into this. What would you say are three tips on creating a sound social media policy?
So I would say that the first thing that would be really useful for anyone to do is to really think about how they use the internet and social media. So for example, I've had a number of clinicians say to me, I'm not on Facebook, or I'm not on Twitter, or I'm not on LinkedIn. I just use email. Is there a reason for me to have a social media policy? And so I say yes, because at least people need to know how you use email, and when you'll respond, and what sorts of things you would like to get via email. You know, do you just want schedule changes, or do you want somebody reporting about their week? Or I would say the most extreme, do you want your clients forwarding exchanges that they've had with other people to you via email for you to, you know, because those things do happen. So my first tip would really be thinking about your own use. And so how that might intersect with a client and the questions a client might have regarding how you're going to respond to them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, not to cut you off, but like, I like that you're grouping email into this broader category of social media.
Yes, absolutely. And the other reason why I do that is because our emails are searchable. So someone could certainly enter our email address into a search engine and they might find activity of ours that we forgot about, something we posted 10 years ago that's now archived and indexed.
I don't know what it's like for you, but like for me, when I'm sending an email, I think about it in the moment, but I don't often think about it, like the long-term implications of it.
Right. How it sits somewhere, or it might end up being archived. Maybe it originally existed in one place and then it gets moved to another place because of the website or community we posted on. So that first tip is really about just assessing your own use. The second tip is to really consider whether you're a person who's going to have an integrated online presence, and by which I mean integrating the personal with the professional. So, and I opted very early on to separate the two, partly because the ethics codes were saying that we were responsible for things we did in our professional lives, but not our personal lives. So I thought, okay, if I use my personal pseudonym online to advertise therapy groups or talk about my work, then I'm opening up that part of my life now as part of my professional world. So people have very different ideas about this. And there are some people who really feel strongly that, for example, people who like work in the recovery community, let's say, or people who work with LGBT folks or transgender or non-binary folks, they may feel like they are part of a small community and that separation doesn't feel natural, or it feels like it would be just strange. So there are some folks who don't separate professional from personal identity online. But I think, so my second tip would be to think about how you're going to handle that and then what that means for your online activity and how you write and share about your professional work in different forums.
So Kaylee, this is going to be a really silly question. So let's say that I get the concept of the integrated think, but the separate. So I guess at a practical level, let's say hypothetically, I wanted to have a separate thing, right? So would this mean, for example, that I would use like one name in my, like, let's just again, go back to Facebook. So would I use one pseudonym or name for my private Facebook page or profile and then a different one for my business, or how does, I'm just curious.
That's a great question because, you know, I'm saying these things as if everyone knows, as if everyone knows what I mean, which I can do at times, but it really, I think, helps to be specific here. So yes, there are some people who manage Facebook as clinicians by having one profile page that uses the name they use for their business, and perhaps they post openings in their groups or practice or presentations they're doing. And then there are other folks who, there might be some folks who actually create a pseudonym, or maybe they use their first and their middle name or something, and that's where they connect to their friends. And that's kind of their personal playground on Facebook. They don't add colleagues there, although certainly many of us are friends with our colleagues. But they do this separating out of, okay, this is my personal life with my friends and family, and then I have my professional profile that's separate.
Would they do this on every social media channel they're active in, or I guess depending on where they want to market their practice would be the expression?
Right. Some people do that, and that is definitely what I did early on when I was doing this. Whereas I have some other friends and colleagues who felt like that was just too cumbersome. And maybe because, for example, as I talked about these small communities that they're a part of, that maybe they're less concerned about what it would be like if a client looked at their profile and saw that they had all these people in common. You know, so they're more comfortable using their real full name. And, you know, they are both a psychologist and a person who spends time socially on Facebook. And they're less guarded about their personal life and less concerned about potential blurring. Does that clarify?
It does. And I was actually thinking, this is, at least in my Facebook group, this has been a newer feature here, probably in the last, I would say less than 2 months. But there's now this option and that Facebook is rolling out where you can actually go into groups, or you can actually submit a request to join a group as a Facebook business page, right? Before, it was you had to actually submit it through your personal profile, which is interesting how that rollout works with what we're talking about now.
Right. And one of the things that I have actually found over time is I've started using my business name and the Dr. Kate Holmes name in a lot of places that I had interest in exploring, just as a way to let my clients know it's me. Because, you know, I think one of the downsides of what I did with the separating of the identities in some ways was not flagging to folks who I am, you know, which raises the possibility for my pseudonym and a client's pseudonym to get entangled in something without our either of us being aware. So there are some ways that I actually feel like if I just use Dr. Kate Holmes everywhere, then at least I'm not accidentally masking myself in situations where a client would want to know they were interacting with me.
That's interesting. I feel like this could get complicated very quickly. Like there's so much like little things to consider.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I have started trying to figure it out, but as time goes on, there's all these new complications to think about, and it makes for this to be a very interesting area of focus for me.
Right. So the first two tips were, again, one is think about how we use social media. And number two is whether you're a person that wants to sort of have an integrated social media presence versus separating them out. What's the third tip that you have?
Yeah, I think the third tip really might be, again, more of an evaluative measure of looking at, you know, if you're doing this today and you haven't yet created a social media policy, maybe thinking about what has happened in your practice. You know, have you had people follow you or request to be a friend or contact on a particular site? Have you had your clients bring in that they saw you online and something you said or did in a forum had an effect on them? Are you confused about whether you can or should Google your patients? You know, so sometimes people have seen my policy and they've said, do I really need a 4 or 5 page document? And I say, no, you don't. Think about what is applicable to your practice, your internet use, and the populations you serve, and including the clinical issues that these folks are bringing in, because, you know, somebody who works in a prison might have different concerns than someone who works with school children. So also, you know, really thinking about what makes sense now for my actual practice and the habits of those people who come to see me and my own habits as a practitioner.
Those are good things to think about. Keely, as we wrap up, I wanted to ask you a question, which is, what would you say are the two biggest issues that you get in your consulting practice in terms of mistakes that clinicians make when it comes to a social media policy?
So that question is kind of tricky. That actually combines two things. Most people are not actually contacting me for consultation about their policies. Mm. It might be easier for me to just talk about the problems people come to me for in consultation.
Yeah, that sounds good. So yeah, so when folks are approaching you for a consultation, what would you say are like the two biggest or the two most common ones?
The two most common concerns I get in consultation are Yelp reviews, where somebody has gotten, sometimes it's a positive review, usually it's a negative review, and clinicians are concerned about what they can do and how they can respond. And it's often very frustrating because we can't do anything that would compromise client confidentiality, even if a person has seemingly identified themselves. That's not the same thing as a signed release of information. You know, we are still expected to uphold that standard. So I'm finding a lot of clinicians to be troubled by negative Yelp reviews. And then the other thing that people consult with me about sometimes is this question of integrated or separate identities. So for example, perhaps somebody wants to start doing a coaching practice, but they don't know whether it would be appropriate or if it would be a risky thing to their practice if they advertise that on their psychotherapy page. Or a person perhaps wants to start writing books or performing. And so it's questions about managing these different aspects of ourselves and safe ways to do that that don't compromise the clinical work with someone who might discover this other aspect of their activities in the world.
I'm glad you mentioned those two, because I can't tell you the amount of conversations that I've seen or just heard about where that's both of those have happened. I feel like each of those could be entire podcast episodes on their own.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they are definitely entire hour-long consultations right. when they occur.
No, but I'm so glad you mentioned them, because I think, especially with like the first one, the Yelp review, like I think that's something that I've noticed. There is like this sense of feeling very disempowered, very vulnerable, and just also, you know, like, I don't know, the sort of emotional part wants to jump in there and counter, right, the Yelp review. Absolutely. But then, so like, what can we do legally?
Right. One thing I will say is that through a few internet searches, and there's certainly some posts on my blog that I can send to you if it's helpful, there have been some cases where people have legally pursued negative reviews, and it is, so far, it has continued to be protected speech. And then, of course, one has to consider, if you do pursue something legally, that that gets documented on the internet. And what is it like for your clients to find out that you pursued a former client legally? So that could be another reputational issue for your practice.
Wow, that's so interesting. Yeah, I would love a link to those articles, and we'll put that on the show notes page for you guys, which you can find over at sellingthecouch.com/session-181. Keely, I'm grateful that we were able to connect finally, and I feel like this is just the tip of the iceberg. But I'm hoping that yes, those of you guys that are listening, that's at least given you a little bit of pause in terms of thinking about social media policies. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for asking me. It was a pleasure. And as you could tell, I can easily geek out on this stuff for quite a while. So
I also know
I wanted you to want me back. I'm happy to come back and talk about it more.
Thank you for saying that. And thank you for being available. I mean this from the bottom of my heart. Like, you're such a wonderful service to our community. I know that this world of social media, for many of us, it is still very intimidating. And I'm so glad that you have the desire to geek out on this stuff to make it so much easier for us. I also wanted to just ask, so you do a couple of types of different consultations. And so where can we learn more about the consulting work you do and some of the other resources?
The consulting work that I do is most easily found at my shop at drkcolmes.com. And I do consultation on clinical and ethical issues related to the internet and social media. And I also do consultation on sexual and gender diversity in practice. And folks can find that information in my shop under Book Consultation Time with Me.
Perfect. Keely, thank you so much for doing this, and have a great rest of your day.
You too. Take good care.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi there. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Keely, and especially I hope that it's given you some insight into thinking about social media policies and all of the different things that go into informed consent when we work with our clients. Keely's website is again over at Dr. K Colmes, that's KOLMES.com. And on the website, there's a place in terms of if you need to consult based on your unique situation. And if you're interested, one of the things that we're working on for STC directory members, you can find more about the directory over at sellingthecouch.com/directory. But Keely is actually going to come on later this year, and we're going to have a live Q&A on this topic of what happens if I get a negative Yelp review. I feel like this is something that a lot of us have struggled with. A lot of us are trying to think about, and I'm looking forward to this conversation because Keely's just a wealth of knowledge on it. And again, you can find more about the directory over at sellingthecouch.com/directory if that's something that you think would be helpful for you. As we wrap up again, just wanted to thank John and the team over at RevKey for supporting today's podcast session. And again, if you guys are looking for help with Google AdWords and Google AdWord campaigns, a lot of our colleagues have had a lot of success with Google AdWords. I encourage you to check out RevKey. They provide an awesome service to our field. And one of the nice things is you don't have to try to figure out Google AdWords. They actually manage everything for you. And so you can work on the things that are important in life, which is seeing clients and spending time with family and versus spending your free time trying to learn Google AdWords. You can learn more about RevKey and the work that they do over at sellingthecouch.com/RevKey. And again, show notes to today's episode can be found over at sellingthecouch.com/session-181. Have a great rest of your day and thank you so much. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
Hey there, hope you enjoyed this replay episode. And again, just wanted to invite you to download the free online course guide if you are thinking about launching an online course and just want some things that have been helpful for me and some of the tough lessons that I learned along the way. You can again download that over at sellingthecouch.com/online course guide. And as I mentioned right at the beginning, we're actually starting a live cohort called Online Course School. This is a great opportunity to join with other therapists to validate and launch and record your online course. The best way to find out about this and to keep updated when the cohort launches is to download, again, the online course guide over at sellingthecouch.com/online course guide.